jacket. The jacket flapped open under the weight. It was the size of a tent. He stepped sideways and patted me down. I was unarmed. My jacket was outside in the Bentley's trunk. Then he stepped back and stood side by side with Teal. Finlay stared at Picard like his heart was breaking.
"What's this all about?"
Finlay said.
"We go back a long way, right?"
Picard just shrugged at him.
"I told you to stay away," he said, "back in March. I tried to stop you coming down here. I warned you off.
That's true, right?
But you wouldn't listen, would you, you stubborn asshole? So you get what you get, my friend."
I listened to Picard's growl and felt worse for Finlay than I did for myself. But then Kleiner stepped in through the door. His bone-hard face was cracked into a grin. His feral teeth glittered. His eyes bored into me. He was carrying another Ithaca Mag-10 in his left hand. In his right hand, he was carrying the gun that had killed Joe. It was pointed straight at me. It was a Ruger Mark II, a sneaky little .22 caliber automatic, fitted with a fat silencer. It was a gun for a killer who enjoys getting close. I stared at it. 9 days ago, the end of that silencer had touched my brother's temple. There was no doubt about that. I could feel it. Picard and Teal moved around behind the desk. Teal sat in the chair. Picard towered over his shoulder. Kleiner was gesturing Finlay and me to sit. He was using his shotgun barrel as a baton, short, jerky movements to move us around. We sat. We were side by side in front of the big rosewood desk. We stared straight at Teal. Kleiner closed the office door and leaned on it. He held the shotgun one-handed at his hip, pointed at the side of my head. The silenced .22 was pointing at the floor. I looked hard at the three of them in turn. Old Teal was staring at me with all kinds of hate showing in his leathery old face. He was shaken up. He looked like a man under terrible stress. He looked desperate, like he was near collapse. He looked 20 years older than the smooth old guy I'd met on Monday. Picard looked better. He had the calm of a great athlete, like a football star or an Olympic champion on a visit to his old high school. But there was a tightening around his eyes, and he was rattling his thumb against his thigh. There was some strain there. I stared sideways at Kleiner, looked hard at him, but there was nothing on show. He was lean and hard and dried out. He didn't move. He was absolutely still. His face and body betrayed nothing. He was like a statue hewn from teak. But his eyes burned with a kind of cruel energy. They sneered at me out of his blank, bone-hard face. Teal rattled open a drawer in the rosewood desk, pulled out the cassette recorder Finlay had used on me, handed it to Picard behind him. Picard put his revolver down on the desk and fiddled with the stiff cords. He plugged in the power, didn't bother with the microphone. They weren't going to record anything. They were going to play us something. Teal leaned forward and thumbed the intercom button on the desk. In the stillness, I heard the buzzers sound faintly outside in the squad room.
"Baker?" Teal said. "In here, please."
Kleiner moved off the door and Baker came in. He was in his uniform, a .38 in his holster. He looked at me, didn't grin. He was carrying two cassettes. Teal took them from him, selected the second one.
"The tape," he said. "Listen up. You're going to find this interesting." He fiddled the cassette in and clicked the little door shut, pressed play. The motor whirred and the speaker hissed. Underneath the hiss, I could hear a boomy acoustic. Then we heard Roscoe's voice. It was loud with panic. It filled the silent office.
Reacher, Roscoe's voice said, this is a message for you, okay? The message is, you better do what they tell you, or I'm in trouble. The message is, if you're in any doubt about what kind of trouble, you should go back down to the morgue and pull Mrs. Morrison's autopsy report. That's the kind of trouble I'm going to be in, so help me out, okay? End of message, Reacher.
Her voice tailed off into the boomy hiss. I heard a faint gasp of pain as if she had been roughly dragged away from the microphone. Then Teal snapped the recorder off. I stared at him. My temperature had dropped away to nothing. I didn't feel human anymore. Picard and Baker were looking at me, beaming in satisfaction, like they were holding the winning hole card. Teal clicked the little door open and took the tape out, laid it on one side on the desk, held up the other tape for me to see and then put it in the machine, closed the little door again and pressed play.
Another one, he said. Listen up.
We heard the same hiss, the same boomy acoustic. Then we heard Charlie Hubble's voice. She sounded hysterical, like she had on Monday morning, standing out on her bright gravel driveway.
Hub, Charlie's voice said, this is Charlie. I've got the children with me. I'm not at home. You understand what that means? I've got to give you a message. If you don't come back, something will happen to the children. They tell me you know what that something is. It's the same thing they said would happen to you and me. But it'll be the children instead, so you have to come back straight away, okay?
The voice ended on a rising note of panic and then died away in the boomy hiss. Teal stabbed the stop button, took the tape out, and placed it carefully on the edge of the desk, right in front of me. Then Kleiner walked around into my field of vision and spoke.
You're going to take that with you, he said to me. You're going to take it to wherever you've hidden Hubble, and you're going to play it to him.
Finley and I looked at each other, just stared at each other in blank astonishment. Then I snapped back and stared at Kleiner.
You killed Hubble already, I said.
Kleiner hesitated for a second.
Don't try that shit, he said.
We were going to, but you got him out of the way. You're hiding him. Charlie told us.
Charlie told you? I said. We asked her where he was, he said. She promised us you'd be able to find him. She was most insistent about it. We had a knife between a little girl's legs at the time. She became very anxious to convince us that her husband was not beyond our reach. She said you'd given him all sorts of advice and guidance. She said you'd given him all sorts of help. She said you'd be able to find him. I hope for everybody's sake she wasn't lying.
You killed him, I said again. I don't know anything about it. Kleiner nodded and sighed. His voice was low.
Let's cut the crap, he said. You're hiding him, and we need him back. We need him back right away. It's a matter of urgency to us. We've got a business to run. So we've got a number of options. We could beat it out of you. We discussed that. It's a tactical problem, right? But we figured you might send us off in the wrong direction because time is tight right now. You might figure that was your best option, right?
He waited for some kind of a comment from me. He didn't get one.
So what we're going to do is this, he said. Picard is going to go with you to pick him up. When you get wherever he is, Picard is going to call me on my mobile. He knows the number. Then you all three come on back here. Okay? I didn't respond. Where is he? Kleiner asked suddenly. I started to speak, but he held up his hand and stopped me. Like I told you, let's cut the crap, he said. For instance, you've been sitting there thinking as hard as you can. No doubt you were trying to figure some way you might be able to take Picard out, but you won't be able to do that. I shrugged, said nothing. Two problems, Kleiner said. I doubt if you could take Picard out. I doubt if anybody could. Nobody ever has. And my mobile number isn't written down. It's in Picard's head. I shrugged again. Kleiner was a smart guy. The worst sort. Let me add a couple of factors, he said. We don't know exactly how far away Hubble is. And you're not going to tell us the truth about that. So I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to give you a time limit. He stopped talking and walked around to where Finlay was sitting. He raised the 22 and put the tip of the silencer in Finlay's ear, pushed it in hard until Finlay was tilting over in his chair. The detective here is going in a cell, he said. He's going to be handcuffed to the bars. If Picard hasn't called me by 1 hour before dawn tomorrow, I'm going to aim my shotgun into the detective's cell and blow him apart. Then I'm going to make the delightful Officer Roscoe clean his guts off the back wall with a sponge. Then I'm going to give you another hour. If Picard hasn't called me by the time the sun comes up, I'm going to start in on the delightful Officer Roscoe herself. She'll end up in a lot of pain, Reacher. But first, there will be a great deal of sexual interference. A great deal. You have my word on that, Reacher. It'll be very messy. Very messy, indeed. Mayor Teal and I have spent a pleasant hour discussing just exactly what we're going to do to her. Kleiner was forcing Finlay practically out of a chair with the pressure of the automatic in his ear. Finlay's lips were clamped. Kleiner was sneering at me. I smiled at him. Kleiner was a dead man. He was as dead as a man who has just jumped off a high building. He hadn't hit the ground yet, but he had jumped. Understand, Kleiner said to me. Call it 6 o'clock tomorrow morning to save Mr. Finlay's life, 7 o'clock to save Miss Roscoe's life. And don't go messing with Picard. Nobody else knows my phone number. I shrugged at him again. Do you understand? He repeated. I think so, I said. Hubble's run away and you don't know how to find him, right? Is that what you're telling me? Nobody spoke. You can't find him, can you? I said. You're useless, Kleiner. You're a useless piece of shit. You think you're some kind of a smart guy, but you can't find Hubble. You couldn't find your asshole if I gave you a mirror on a stick. I could hear that Finlay wasn't breathing. He thought I was playing with his life. But old man Kleiner left him alone, moved across into my field of vision again. He had gone pale. I could smell his stress. I was just about getting used to the idea that Hubble was still alive. He had been dead all week, and now he was alive again. He was alive and hiding out somewhere. He'd been hiding out somewhere all week while they looked for him.
He was on the run. He hadn't been dragged out of his house on Monday morning. He had walked out by himself. He'd taken that stay-at-home call and smelled a rat and run for his life. And they couldn't find him. Paul Hubble had given me the tiny edge I was going to need.
"What's Hubble got that you want so much?" I said.
Kleiner shrugged at me.
"He's the only loose end left," he said. "I've taken care of everything else, and I'm not going out of business just because an asshole like Hubble is running around somewhere shooting his stupid mouth off. So I need him at home, where he belongs. So you're going to get him for me."
I leaned forward and stared right into his eyes.
"Can't your son get him for you?" I said quietly.
Nobody spoke. I leaned forward some more.
"Tell your boy to go pick him up," I said.
Kleiner was silent.
"Where's your son, Kleiner?" I asked him.
He didn't say anything.
"What happened to him?" I said.
"Do you know?"
He knew, but he didn't know. I could see that. He hadn't accepted it. He had sent his boy after me, and his boy hadn't come back, so he knew, but he hadn't admitted it to himself. His hard face went slack. He wanted to know, but he couldn't ask me. He wanted to hate me for killing his boy, but he couldn't do that either, because to do that would be to admit it was true. I stared at him. He wanted to raise that big shotgun and blow me into a red dew, but he couldn't, because he needed me to get Hubble back. He was churning away inside. He wanted to shoot me right then, but 40 tons of money was more important to him than his son's life. I stared into his dead eyes, unblinking, spoke softly.
"Where's your son, Kleiner?" I said.
There was silence in the office for a long time.
"Get him out of here," Kleiner said. "If you're not out of here in 1 minute, Reacher, I'll shoot the detective right now."
I stood up, looked around the five of them, nodded to Finley, headed out. Picard followed me and closed the door quietly. 30. Picard and I walked out together through the squad room. It was deserted, quiet. The desk sergeant was gone. Teal must have sent him away. The coffee machine was on. I could smell it. I saw Roscoe's desk. I saw the big bulletin board. The Morrison investigation. It was still empty, no progress. I dodged around the reception counter, pushed open the heavy glass door against its stiff rubber seal, stepped out into the bright afternoon. Picard signaled with the stubby gun barrel that I should get in the Bentley and drive. I didn't argue with the guy, just headed across the lot to the car. I was closer to panic than I'd ever been in my whole life. My heart was thumping, and I was taking little short breaths. I was putting one foot in front of the other and using every ounce of everything I had just to stay in control. I was telling myself that when I arrived at that driver's door, I better have some damn good idea about what the hell I was going to do next. I got into the Bentley and drove up to Eno's diner, reached around to the seat pocket and found the map, walked over through the bright afternoon sun and pushed in through Eno's door, slid into an empty booth, ordered coffee and eggs. I was screaming at myself to listen to what I had learned through 13 hard years. The shorter the time, the cooler you've got to be. If you've only got one shot, you've got to make it count. You can't afford to miss because you screwed up the planning, or because you ran out of blood sugar and got sick and dizzy in the small hours of the morning. so I forced the eggs down and drank the coffee. Then I pushed the empty mug and the plate aside and spread the map on the table. Started looking for Hubble. He could be anywhere, but I had to find him. I had one shot at it. I couldn't rush around from place to place. I had to find him inside my head. It had to be a thought process. I had to find him inside my head first, and then go straight to him. So I bent over Eno's table, stared at the map, stared at it for a long time. I spent the best part of an hour with the map. Then I folded it up and squared it on the table, picked up the knife and the fork from the egg plate, palmed them into my trouser pocket, looked around me. The waitress walked over, the one with glasses.
"Planning a trip, honey?"
she asked me. I looked up at her. I could see myself reflected in her glasses. I could see Picard's huge bulk glowering in the booth behind me. I could just about feel his hand wrapping tight around the butt of his 38. I nodded at the woman. "That's the idea," I said. "A hell of a trip. The trip of a lifetime." She didn't know what to say to that.
"Well, you take care, okay?" she said.
I got up and left one of Charlie's hundreds on the table for her. Maybe it was real. Maybe it wasn't. It would spend just the same. And I wanted to leave her a big tip. Eno was getting a dirty grand a week, but I didn't know if he was passing much of it on. Probably not, looking at the guy.
"See you again, mister,"
the one with glasses said. "Maybe," I said. Picard pushed me out through the door. It was 4 o'clock. I hustled over the gravel to the Bentley. Picard followed me with his hand in his pocket. I slid in and fired it up, eased out of the lot and scooted north, up the old county road. Blasted the 14 miles away in about 12 minutes. Picard had made me use the Bentley, not his own car. Had to be a reason for that. Not just because he wanted the extra legroom. Because it was a very distinctive car, which meant there was going to be extra insurance. I looked in the mirror and picked up a plain sedan, about 100 yards behind. 2 guys in it. I shrugged to myself, slowed, and glanced left at the warehouses at the top of the county road, swooped up the ramp and round the cloverleaf. Hit the highway going as fast as I dared. Time was crucial. The road skirted us around the southeast corner of the Atlanta sprawl. I threaded through the interchanges, headed due east on I-20. Cruised on with the 2 guys in their plain sedan 100 yards back, mile after mile.
"So where is he?" Picard asked me.
It was the first time he'd spoken since leaving the station house. I glanced across at him and shrugged.
"No idea," I said. "Best I can do is go find a friend of his in Augusta."
"Who's his friend?" he said.
"Guy called Lennon," I said.
"In Augusta," he said.
"Augusta," I said. "That's where we're going."
Picard grunted. We cruised on. The 2 guys stayed behind us.
"So who is this guy in Augusta?" Picard said.
"Lennon."
"Friend of Hubble's," I said, "like I told you."
"He doesn't have a friend in Augusta," he said.
"Don't you think we check things like that?"
I shrugged, didn't reply.
"You better not be bullshitting, my friend," Picard said. "Kleiner wouldn't like that. It'll make it worse for the woman. He's got a cruel streak in him, a mile wide, believe me. I've seen him in action."
"Like when?" I said.
Lots of times, he said. Like Wednesday at the airport. That woman, Molly Beth, screamer. He enjoys that. Like Sunday, up at the Morrison place. Kleiner was there Sunday, I said. He loved it, Picard said. Him and his damn son. You did the world a favor taking that kid out. You should have seen him on Sunday. We gave those two cops the day off. Didn't seem right they should off their own chief. The Kleiners and I stood in for them. The old man loved every minute of it. Cruel streak a mile wide, like I said. You better make sure I get to make that call on time, or your woman friend's in a lot of trouble. I went quiet for a moment. I had seen the Kleiner kid on Sunday. He had picked his stepmother up from the coffee shop. About 10:30, he'd been staring at me. He'd been on his way back from dismembering the Morrisons. Did old man Kleiner shoot my brother? I asked Picard. Thursday night, he said. Sure. That's his weapon, the .22 with his suppressor. And then the kid kicked him around, I said. Picard shrugged. The kid was berserk, he said. Wrong in the head. And then Morrison was supposed to clean up, I said. Supposed to, Picard grunted. Asshole was supposed to burn the bodies in the car. But he couldn't find Stoller's body, so he just left both of them there. And Kleiner killed 8 guys in Louisiana, right? I said. Picard laughed. 8 they know about, he said. That asshole Spirenza was on his back for a year, looking for payments to a shooter. But there never was a shooter. Kleiner did it all himself. Like a hobby, right? You knew Kleiner back then? I said. I've always known Kleiner, he said. Got myself assigned as Spirenza's bureau liaison. Kept everything neat and tidy. We drove on in silence for a mile or two. The two guys in the plain sedan kept station 100 yards behind the Bentley. Then Picard looked at me. This guy, Lena, he said. He's not another damn treasury spook working for your brother, right? Friend of Hubble's, I said. Like hell, he said. We checked. He's got no friends in Augusta. Hell, he's got no friends anywhere. He thought Kleiner was his damn friend, giving him a job and all. Picard started chuckling to himself in the passenger seat. His giant frame was shaking with mirth. Like Finlay thought you were his friend, right? I said. He shrugged. I tried to keep him away, he said. I tried to warn him off. So what should I do? Get myself killed on his behalf? I didn't answer that. We cruised on in silence. The plain sedan sat steady 100 yards back. We need gas, I said. Picard craned over and peered at the needle. It was nudging the red. Pull over at the next place, he said. I saw a sign for gas near a place called Madison. I pulled off and drove the Bentley over to the pumps, chose the furthest island, and eased to a stop. Are you going to do this for me? I asked Picard. He looked at me in surprise. No, he said. What the hell do you think I am? A damn pump jockey? Do it yourself. That was the answer I wanted to hear. I got out of the car. Picard got out on the other side. The plain sedan pulled up close by, and the two guys got out. I looked them over. They were the same two I had scuffled with in New York, on that crowded sidewalk outside Kelstein's college. The smaller guy had his khaki raincoat on.
I nodded amiably to the two of them. I figured they had less than an hour to live. They strolled over and stood with Picard in a knot of three. I unhooked the nozzle and shoved it in the Bentley's tank. It was a big tank, well over 20 gallons. I trapped my finger under the trigger on the nozzle so that it wouldn't pump at full speed. I held it in a casual backhand grip and leaned against the car as the gas trickled in. I wondered whether I should start whistling. Picard and the two Hispanics lost interest. There was a breeze coming up, and they shuffled about in the slight evening chill. I slipped Eno's flatware out of my pocket and pressed the tip of the knife into the tire tread next to my right knee. From where Picard was standing, it looked like I was maybe rubbing my leg. Then I took the fork and bent one of the tines outward, pressed it into the cut I had made, and snapped it off, left a half inch sticking into the tire. Then I finished up pumping the gas and latched the nozzle back into the pump. "You paying for this?" I called to Picard. He looked around and shrugged, peeled the bill off his roll, and sent the guy in the raincoat off to pay. Then we got back into the car.
"Wait," Picard said.
I waited until the plain sedan had started up behind me and flashed its headlights twice. Then I moved out and accelerated gently back onto the highway and settled into the same steady cruise. Kept on going, and the signs started flashing past. Augusta, 70 miles. Augusta, 60 miles. Augusta, 40 miles. The old Bentley hummed along, rock steady. The two guys followed. The setting sun behind me was red in the mirror. The horizon up ahead was black. It was already night, far out over the Atlantic Ocean. We drove on. The rear tire went flat about 20 miles out from Augusta. It was past 7:30, and it was getting dark. We both felt the rumbling from the wheel, and the car wouldn't track straight.
"Shit," I said. "Flat tire." "Pull over," Picard said.
I slowed to a stop well over on the shoulder. The plain sedan pulled over and stopped behind us. We all four got out. The breeze had freshened up to a cold wind blowing in from the east. I shivered and popped the trunk, picked up my jacket and put it on like I was grateful for the warmth. "Spare wheels under the trunk floor," I said to Picard. "Want to help me get this box out?" Picard stepped over and looked at the box of dollar bills.
"We burned the wrong house," he said, and laughed.
He and I heaved the heavy box out and set it on its end on the highway shoulder. Then he pulled his gun out and showed it to me. His huge jacket was flapping in the wind.
"We'll let the little guys change the wheel," he said.
"You stand still. Right there, next to the box." He waved the two Hispanics over and told them to do the work. They found the jack and the wrench for the bolts, jacked up the car and took the wheel off. Then they lined up the spare and lifted it into place, bolted it carefully on. I was standing there, next to the carton of money, shivering in the wind, wrapping my coat tight around me, thrusting my hands deep in the pockets and stamping from foot to foot, trying to look like a guy who was getting cold, standing around doing nothing. I waited until Picard stepped around to check the bolts were tight. He put his weight on the lever, and I could hear the metal grunching. I came out with Morrison's switchblade already open and sliced up one side of the air conditioner box, then across the top, then down the other side. Before Picard could line up his gun, the box fell open like a steamer trunk, and the wind caught 100
$1,000 bills and blew them all over the highway like a blizzard. Then I dove over the concrete wall at the edge of the shoulder and rolled down the shallow bank, pulled out the Desert Eagle, shot at the guy with the raincoat as he came over the wall after me, but I missed my aim and just blew his leg away. Beyond him, I saw a truck with dollar bills plastered all over its windshield run off the road and smash into the plain sedan behind the Bentley. Picard was batting away the snowstorm of cash and dancing over to the wall. I could hear tires shrieking as cars on the highway braked and swerved to avoid the wreckage of the truck. I rolled over and aimed up the bank and shot the second Hispanic guy, caught him through the chest, and he came crashing down toward me. The guy with the raincoat was rolling around at the top of the slope, screaming, clutching his shattered leg, trying to free the small automatic he had shown me in New York. I fired a third time and shot him through the head. I could see Picard aiming his .38 down at me. All the time, the wind was howling and cars were sliding to a stop on the highway. I could see drivers getting out and jumping around, snatching at the money swirling in the air. It was chaos. "Don't shoot me, Picard," I yelled. "You won't get Hubble if you do." He knew that, and he knew he was a dead man if he didn't get Hubble. Kleiner wouldn't tolerate failure. He stood there with his .38 aimed at my head, but he didn't shoot. I ran up the bank and circled the car, forcing him out toward the traffic with the Desert Eagle. "You don't shoot me here," Picard screamed. "My phone call is the only way you're going to save that woman, that's for sure. You better believe it." "I know that, Picard," I yelled back. "I believe it. I'm not going to shoot you. Are you going to shoot me?" He shook his head over the .38. "I'm not going to shoot you, Reacher," he said. It looked like a stalemate. We circled the Bentley with our fingers white on the triggers, telling each other we weren't going to shoot. He was telling the truth, but I was lying. I waited until he was lined up with the wreckage of the truck and I was next to the Bentley. Then I pulled the trigger. The .44 shell caught him and smashed his huge bulk backward into the tangled metal. I didn't wait around for a second shot. I slammed the trunk lid and jumped for the driver's seat, fired the car up and burned rubber. I peeled away from the shoulder and dodged the people running around after the dollar bills, jammed my foot down and hurtled east. 20 miles to go. Took me 20 minutes. I was gasping and shaky with adrenaline. I forced my heartbeat down and took big gulps of air. Then I yelled to myself in triumph, screamed, and yelled out loud. Picard was gone.
31. It was dark when I hit the outlying Augusta suburbs. I pulled off the highway as soon as the taller buildings started to thicken up, drove down the city streets, and stopped at the first motel I saw. Locked the Bentley up and dodged into the office, stepped over to the desk. The clerk looked up. "Got a room?" I asked him.
$36, the guy said.
"Phone in the room?" I asked him.
"Sure," he said. "Air conditioning and cable TV."
"Yellow Pages in the room?" I asked him. He nodded.
"Got a map of Augusta?" I said.
He jerked his thumb over to a rack next to his cigarette machine. It was stuffed with maps and brochures. I peeled off $36 from the roll in my trouser pocket, dropped the cash on the desk, filled in the register. I put my name down as Roscoe Finley.
"Room 12, the guy said,
slid me the key. I stopped to grab a map and hustled out, ran down the road to room 12, let myself in and locked the door. I didn't look at the room, just looked for the phone and the Yellow Pages. I lay in the bed and unfolded the map, opened up the Yellow Pages to H for hotels. There was a huge list.
In Augusta, there were hundreds of places where you could pay for a bed for the night. Literally, hundreds. Pages and pages of them. So I looked at the map, concentrated on a wedge a half mile long and four blocks deep, either side of the main drag in from the west. That was my target area. I downgraded the places right on the main drag. I upgraded the places a block or two off, prioritized the places between a quarter mile and a half mile out. I was looking at a rough square, a quarter mile long and a quarter mile deep. I put the map and the phone book side by side and made a hit list. 18 hotels. One of them was the place I was lying there in. So I picked up the phone and dialed 0 for the desk. The clerk answered. "You got a guy called Paul Lennon registered?" I asked him. There was a pause. He was checking the book. "Lennon," he said. "No, sir." "Okay," I said. Put the phone down. I took a deep breath and started at the top of my list. Dialed the first place. "You got a guy called Paul Lennon registered?" I asked the guy who answered. There was a pause. "No, sir," the guy said. I worked down the list, dialed one place after another. "You got a guy called Paul Lennon registered?" I asked each clerk. There was always a pause while they checked their registers. Sometimes I could hear the pages turning. Some of them had computers. I could hear keyboards pattering. "No, sir," they all said, one after the other. I lay there on the bed with the phone balanced on my chest. I was down to number 13 out of the 18 on my list. "You got a guy called Paul Lennon registered?" I asked. There was a pause. I could hear pages turning. "No, sir," the 13th clerk said. "Okay," I said. Put the phone down. I picked it up again and stabbed out the 14th number. Got a busy signal. So I dabbed the cradle and stabbed out the 15th number. "You got a guy called Paul Lennon registered?" I asked. There was a pause.
"Room 120?
The 15th clerk said. "Thank you," I said. Put the phone down. I lay there, closed my eyes, breathed out. I put the phone back on the nightstand thing and checked the map. The 15th hotel was 3 blocks away, north of the main drag. I left the room key on the bed and went back out to the car. The engine was still warm. I'd been in there about 25 minutes. I had to drive 3 blocks east before I could make a left, then 3 blocks north before I could make another. I went around a kind of jagged spiral. I found the 15th hotel and parked at the door. Went into the lobby. It was a dingy sort of place, not clean, not well lit. It looked like a cave.
"Can I help you?"
the desk guy asked. "No," I said. I followed an arrow down a warren of corridors, found room 120, rapped on the door. I heard the rattle of the chain going on. I stood there. The door cracked open.
"Hello, Reacher,"
he said. "Hello, Hubble," I said. He was spilling over with questions for me, but I just hustled him out to the car. We had 4 hours on the road for all that stuff. We had to get going. I was over 2 hours ahead of schedule. I wanted to keep it that way. I wanted to put those 2 hours in the bank. I figured I might need them later. He looked okay. He wasn't a wreck. He'd been running for 6 days, and it had done him good. It had burned off that complacent gloss he had had, left him looking a little more tight and rangy, a bit tougher, more like my type of a guy. He was dressed up in cheap chain store clothes, and he was wearing socks. He was using an old pair of spectacles made from stainless steel. A $7 digital watch covered the band of pale skin where the Rolex had been. He looked like a plumber, or the guy who runs your local muffler franchise. He had no bags. He was traveling light. He just glanced around his room and walked out with me, like he couldn't believe his life on the road was over, like he might be going to miss it to a degree. We stepped through the dark lobby and out into the night. He stopped when he saw the car parked at the door.
"You came in Charlie's car?" he said.
"She was worried about you," I told him. "She asked me to find you." He nodded, looked blank.
"What's with the tinted glass?" he said.
I grinned at him and shrugged.
"Don't ask," I said. "Long story."
I started up and eased away from the hotel. He should have asked me right away how Charlie was, but something was bothering him. I had seen when he cracked the hotel room door that a tidal wave of relief had hit him, but he had a tiny reservation. It was a pride thing. He'd been running and hiding. He had thought he'd been doing it well, but he hadn't been, because I had found him. He was thinking about that. He was relieved and disappointed all at the same time.
"How the hell did you find me?" he asked.
I shrugged at him again.
"Easy," I said. "I've had a lot of practice. I've found a lot of guys. Spent years picking up deserters for the army."
I was threading through the grids, working my way back to the highway. I could see the line of lights streaming west, but the on-ramp was like the prize at the center of a maze. I was unwinding the same jagged spiral I'd been forced around on the way in.
"But how did you do it?"
he said. "I could have been anywhere."
"No, you couldn't," I said. That was the exact point. That's what made it easy. You had no credit cards, no driver's license, no ID. All you had was cash. So you weren't using planes or rental cars. You were stuck with the bus.
I found the on-ramp, concentrated on the lane change and nudged the wheel, accelerated up the ramp and merged with the flow toward Atlanta.
"That gave me a start," I said to him.
"Then I put myself in your shoes, psychologically. You were terrified for your family, so I figured you'd circle around my grave at a distance. You'd want to feel you were still connected, consciously or subconsciously. You took the taxi up to the Atlanta bus depot, right?"
"Right," he said.
"First bus out of there was to Memphis, but I waited for the next one. Memphis was too far. I didn't want to go that far away."
"That's what made it easy," I said. "You were circling my grave. Not too close, not too far, and counterclockwise. Give people a free choice, they always go counterclockwise. It's a universal truth, Hubble. All I had to do was to count the days and study the map and predict the hop you'd take each time. I figured Monday you were in Birmingham, Alabama. Tuesday was Montgomery. Wednesday was Columbus. I had a problem with Thursday. I gambled on Macon, but I thought it was maybe too close to Margrave." He nodded.
"First it was a nightmare," he said. "I was in Macon. Some terrible dive. Didn't sleep a wink."
"So Friday morning you came out here to Augusta," I said.
"My other big gamble was you stayed here two nights. I figured you were shaken up after Macon, maybe running out of energy. I really wasn't sure. I nearly went up to Greenville tonight, up in South Carolina."
"But I guessed right."
Hubble went quiet. He had thought he'd been invisible, but he'd been circling my grave like a beacon flashing away in the night sky.
"But I used a false name," he said, defiantly.
"You used five false names," I said. "Five nights, five hotels, five names. The fifth name was the same as the first name, right?"
He was amazed. He thought back and nodded.
"How the hell did you know that?" he said again.
"I've hunted a lot of guys," I said.
"And I knew a little about you."
"Knew what?" he said.
"You're a Beatles guy," I said.
You told me about visiting the Dakota building and going to Liverpool in England. You've got just about every Beatles CD ever made in your den. So the first night you were at some hotel desk and you signed Paul Lennon, right?
Right, he said.
Not John Lennon, I said. People usually stick with their own first name. I don't know why, but they usually do. So you were Paul Lennon. Tuesday, you were Paul McCartney. Wednesday, you were Paul Harrison. Thursday, you were Paul Starr. Friday in Augusta, you started over again with Paul Lennon, right?
Right, he said. But there's a million hotels in Augusta.
Conventions? Golf? How the hell did you know where to look? I thought about it, I said. You get in Friday, late morning, coming in from the west. Guy like you walks back the way he's already seen. Feels safer that way. You'd been on the bus 4 hours. You were cramped up. You wanted the air, so you walked a spell. Maybe a quarter mile. Then you got panicky and dived off the main drag a block or two. So I had a pretty small target area. 18 places. You were in number 15. He shook his head. Mixed feelings. We barreled on down the road in the dark. The big old Bentley loped along, a hair over the legal limit.
How are things in Margrave now?
He asked me. That was the big question. He asked it tentatively, like he was nervous about it. I was nervous about answering it. I backed off the gas a little and slowed down. Just in case he got so upset that he grabbed at me. I didn't want to wreck the car. Didn't have time for that. We're in deep shit, I told him. We've got about 7 hours to fix it. I saved the worst part for last. I told him Charlie and the kids had gone with an FBI agent back on Monday because of the danger. And then I told him the FBI agent had been Picard. There was silence in the car. I drove on 3-4 miles in the silence. It was more than a silence. It was a crushing vacuum of stillness, like all the atmosphere had been sucked off the planet. It was a silence that roared and buzzed in my ears. He started clenching and unclenching his hands, started rocking back and forth on the big leather chair beside me. But then he went quiet. His reaction never really got going, never really took hold. His brain just shut down and refused to react anymore, like a circuit breaker clicking open. It was too big and too awful to react to. He just looked at me.
Okay, he said.
Then you'll have to get them back, won't you? I sped up again, charged on toward Atlanta. I'll get them back, I said, but I'll need your help. That's why I picked you up first. He nodded again. He had crashed through the barrier. He had stopped worrying and started relaxing. He was up on that plateau where you just did whatever needed doing. I knew that place. I lived there. 20 miles out from Augusta, we saw flashing lights up ahead and guys waving danger flares. There was an accident on the other side of the divider. A truck had plowed into a parked sedan. A gaggle of other vehicles were slewed all over the place. There were drifts of what looked like litter lying around. A big crowd of people was milling about, collecting it up. We crawled past in a slow line of traffic. Hubble watched out the window.
I'm very sorry about your brother, he said. I had no idea. I guess I got him killed, didn't I?
He slumped down in the seat, but I wanted to keep him talking. He had to stay on the ball. So I asked him the question I'd been waiting a week to ask. How the hell did you get into all this? I said. He shrugged, blew a big sigh at the windshield, like it was impossible to imagine any way of getting into it,
like it was impossible to imagine any way of staying out of it.
I lost my job, he said, a simple statement. I was devastated. I felt angry and upset and scared, Reacher. We'd been living a dream, you know, a golden dream. It was a perfect, idyllic life. I was earning a fortune and I was spending a fortune. It was totally fabulous. But then I started hearing things. The retail operation was under threat. My department was under review. I suddenly realized I was just one paycheck away from disaster. Then the department got shut down. I got canned, and the paychecks stopped. And, I said, I was out of my head, he said. I was so angry. I had worked my butt off for those bastards. I was good at my job. I had made them a fortune, and they just slung me out like suddenly I was shit on their shoe. And I was scared. I was going to lose it all, right? And I was tired. I couldn't start again at the bottom of something else. I was too old, and I had no energy. I just didn't know what to do. And then Kleiner turned up, I said. He nodded, looked pale. He had heard about it, he said. I guess Teal told him. Teal knows everything about everybody. Kleiner called me within a couple of days. I hadn't even told Charlie at that point. I couldn't face it. He called me and asked me to meet him up at the airport. He was in a private jet on his way back from Venezuela. He flew me out to the Bahamas for lunch, and we talked. I was flattered, to be honest. And, I said, he gave me a lot of crap, Hubble said. He was telling me to look at it as an opportunity to get out. He was saying I should dump the corporate thing. I should come into a real job, make some real money with him. I didn't know much about him. I knew about the family fortune and the foundation, obviously, but I had never met him face to face. But he was clearly a very rich and successful guy. And very, very smart. And there he was, sitting in a private jet, asking me to work with him. Not for him, with him. I was flattered, and I was desperate, and I was worried, and I said yes. And then, I said. He called me again the next day, Opal said. He was sending the plane for me. I had to fly down to the Kleiner plant in Venezuela to meet with him. So I did. I was only there one day, didn't get to see anything. Then he flew me to Jacksonville. I was in a lawyer's office for a week. After that, it was too late. I couldn't get out. Why not? I asked him. It was a hell of a week, he said. It sounds like a short time, right? Just a week? But he did a real job on me. First day it was all flattery, all temptation. He signed me up to a huge salary, bonuses, whatever I wanted. We went to clubs and hotels, and he was spending money like it was out of a faucet. Tuesday, I started work. The actual job was a challenge. It was very difficult after what I had been doing at the bank. It was so specialized. He wanted cash, of course, but he wanted dollars only, nothing but singles. I had no idea why. And he wanted records, very tight books. But I could handle it, and he was a relaxed boss, no pressures, no problems. The problem started Wednesday. How? I said. Wednesday, I asked him what was going on, he said.
And he told me. He just told me exactly what he was doing. But he said now, I was doing it too. I was involved. I had to stay quiet. Thursday, I was getting really unhappy.